and welcome to The Pulse. I'm Rebecca and I'm joined by Freya and Joe. Today we are going to be discussing the response from the SU's letter to the university and government from the Vice Chancellor, Professor Shira West, and also we're going to be discussing the potential Tier 3 restrictions that may be coming into place very soon. We're also going to be discussing Generation COVID and the way that the research is on how the how basically our generation has been affected by the pandemic. We're also going to be talking about Poland's abortion ruling and protesters who are disrupting church services. So we're going to start off with talking about the response from the Vice Chancellor about what the SU's complaints were. Basically, to summarise sort of the letter, it's fairly what you, I guess maybe you might expect, fairly, we were talking before the show and we all sort of agreed that it was fairly diplomatic, and it's not, there's not a lot of information. I wouldn't say there are a lot of like responses to these specific complaints. It was more sort of general arguments, as you can imagine, that they've increased a lot of help, there've been a lot of mental health support services, because that was one of the complaints of the original SU letter, and that they don't think that online teaching is beneficial for the students, and that there have been, you know, there's been a lot of testing, which is sort of a unique aspect of Nottingham University being able to do that. They've also talked about the fact that they've, you know, helped trying to basically improve the situation. There's been a massive reduction of cases. That was another thing they sort of emphasised, was the fact that it's reduced massively from 1,530 to 476, I think it says. So there's a considerable less number of active cases of COVID. And basically that they sort of sympathised with the students. It wasn't, I didn't feel there was a lot of substance to the letter. What did you guys think of the letter?
I mean, I think she was right to point out that cases are dropping among students. I think even since she's published the letter, it's now down to about 241 active cases. And also to sing the praises of, you know, on-campus testing facilities. I know myself and Freya, as we've both felt that the on-campus testing facilities are really be quite proud of. But yeah, equally, talking about online teaching, again, this term blended learning, which I'm not sure anyone really knows what it means. Again, quite an abstract picture.
Yeah, I completely agree, Joe. The letter itself, like you said, was quite diplomatic. I think that's in part due to the original SU letter being quite abstract in what it was sort of asking for the university. So in terms of like any commitments to changing anything, I thought the letter was fairly sparse. But I mean, I appreciate this. They're in a difficult situation and she was probably just trying to sort of sing the praises of the SU and sort of placate everybody a bit.
Yeah, I definitely felt... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't know whether there's a kind of disconnect between students to online teaching and to the university approach. I mean, I've been in seminars this week where people are quite happy to carry on with online learning. I don't quite know because of safety concerns or whether it's just more convenient. But obviously the emphasis letter that online teaching give the same value suggests that students will be encouraged to come back on campus for learning.
Yeah, I definitely picked that up, and I wasn't surprised by that, because I think often there has been criticism that if it is all online, you should be paying basically the equivalent of what an online university would be. The example, obviously, that people usually use is the online university, which I think is considerably less. I don't know, I can't remember exactly how much. I think it's like £3,000.
Yeah, I think it's about that.
Yeah, something like that. So it is less. That being said, I mean, I don't know how it actually compares to like an open university, in that there have been a lot more, you know, we have a lecture engagements and all these sort of, I think those are the things that they refer to as part of the blended learning, which is a slightly vacuous sort of phrase. But yeah, I think maybe in that sense, I don't know how it compares, so maybe they have been doing sort of more things than you would normally get anyway. But I do sort of think that I don't know how the university is going to keep that argument up if we're going to move into tier 3, which is possibly, and this is going on to also the other aspect of the story, is that there have been basically very strong suggestions that we are going into tier 3 I think next week. So talks are ongoing to determine how tier 3 could look in Nottinghamshire, with closely linked sources saying local lockdown restrictions are still not a done deal. Politicians have been told to expect Nottingham City, Gelding, Broxtowe and Rushcliffe to enter tier 3 lockdown this week, with an announcement expected before Wednesday. And Lillian Greenwood, Labour MP for Nottingham South, said despite delays from the government in commencing talks with local leaders, it's clear that Nottingham City and those three boroughs will definitely be going into tier 3. So those are basically the student areas, pretty much, I would say. Obviously, it depends if you live a little bit further out, but
Yeah. Generally
speaking, those are student areas. An announcement is expected today on October 26th, with restrictions potentially in place by Wednesday. The financial support for councils as well, as revenues will be told to close, and those are the sort of sticking points. So I think that's going to take place, probably. I think so. Talks are taking place now, I think, is the situation between these sort of the leaders of Nottinghamshire, Gedling, Broxtowe and Rushcliffe. So it looks like we are going to go into tier 3, and tier 3 is obviously restrictions on things like you can't go into pubs and restaurants, is my understanding, and you can't like meet with so you can't meet with,
it feels people. A little bit like Groundhog.
Yeah a little bit so you can't you can't socialise with anyone you don't live with, or you also, so the rule of six I think still applies, and schools and universities do remain open. I think that would mean then that our seminars and stuff would remain the same, I think, but this does seem to be in a little bit contradiction with what the university is saying, like in that, you know, they're saying cases are going down, you know, it's all going away sort of thing, and it doesn't seem to be that's the situation.
Yeah, think absolutely. Perhaps...
Sorry, Freya. I think perhaps it's evidence that whilst the virus numbers are coming down in the student population, it's perhaps spreading through the older population, and it is just typical. It's sort of, it's shame that it feels like a lot of students are coming out of isolation around about this time, not really sure what's going on, and we're all going to be forced inside again. And I don't know whether it will actually have any kind of alteration of behaviour, because when we were talking 2 weeks ago, they were in talks going into tier 2. And it does just feel like Groundhog Day again. I can't see that closing the pubs will really have much effect, because people will be forced inside and you know, will mingle amongst households more.
Yeah, I agree. I think I understand that we're sort of in the beginning stages of this new tiered system, and that obviously requires a bit of figuring out, but sort of the directives that we've seen from the government seem to be coming just 2 weeks too late. You know, we could have used discussions of whether tier 3 should be happening when the cases were much higher last week. And now the cases are on the way down, but we're just talking about introducing tier 3 measures. So it just feels like everything's a week, 2 weeks behind what it needs to be tackling it properly.
Yeah, I agree. You would have thought really from March, where this was also the sort of complaint around then, that the government was 2 weeks behind. You would have thought that they'd have learnt from this perhaps, and maybe learnt to put in measures earlier rather than later. I definitely do feel also like it does seem a little bit ironic, because I would have thought as the cases are dropping, I don't know that it definitely has anything to do with freshers and the beginning of university, but I would imagine that the higher numbers within the actual university were quite possibly to do with that, and consequently have been going down a little bit as people have been getting more into studies and so on. So it does seem a little bit sort of backwards that we're now sort of increasing measures rather than the opposite way around. And I don't really necessarily know what this means for the university. I would assume, because it is a school and an education, that nothing is actually going to change within the university, and that it is just spreading sort of outside, even though, again, it's mainly university areas that they're talking about putting into the tier three into. I mean, do you guys think this is going to have a big impact on student life? Do you think it's going to be backlash?
Joe?
Certainly, I so, because, again, it does feel like we're getting the brunt of it. You know, I just said that it's typical that our numbers are falling on the face of it, and kind of, you know, social life is being suppressed again. But equally, I don't feel that the government can be seen not to be doing anything in Nottingham when we've had the whole kind of situation in Manchester and Liverpool, where the cases, I don't think, ever got to the levels that they got to here.
Yeah, that has been a massive period of controversy, especially in Manchester, this idea of sort of going back into... The problem with Tier 3 as well is the pubs and the restaurants, because these are businesses that are potentially going to be able to go to fail because of the way that the government initiatives often work. Often, I think my understanding is that basically you sort of have to be open to be able to benefit from them, so they sort of subsidise you for, like, the money you make, if that makes sense. And as a consequence, this is quite... It would be quite a big deal if people couldn't go into bars and restaurants and pubs. So that was basically Manchester's complaint, was that they needed more financial support. And I think it would look a bit dodgy if it was just Manchester and Liverpool and things that were going into Tier 3 and then Nottingham didn't, because that... I mean, Nottingham was all in the news when just before it went into Tier 2 about the fact that it was... really high in cases. I think it does also have things to do with, like, how much your hospital capacity is and things like that. So I think that can be sort of things that maybe people don't always realise. It's not always just to do with, like, raw number of cases. And also, because it was largely students as well, I think a lot of the cases weren't ending up in, like, hospital. There are sort of other factors, but yeah, I definitely think it wouldn't look good to just be sending places like Manchester and Liverpool into Tier 3 and then not Nottingham. It just doesn't really make sense not to do that. I was also going to ask, do you guys feel like the university has sort of responded and is sort of dealing with COVID in a way that, like, you're pleased with? I did feel that the letter was a little bit vague.
As much as any university in the country is dealing with it well, I think Nottingham's, like, keeping up with the pack in that sort of respect. Certainly the on-campus social distancing measures, I think, are quite good. I think there's a lot of problems that come along with online learning, none of which are really unique to Nottingham. But I don't really know what the answer is to how to solve them.
I agree. I don't really have a frame of reference. I don't think anyone really, anyone. But yeah, I agree. I think we're sort of keeping the pack, and not doing too bad, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I think the university has put in a lot of initiatives. I think maybe they could have done a little bit more signposting and things like that. Like, for instance, like in my university accommodation, I'm sort of like, I'm in a flat, but it's sort of like it's student accommodation, and I think it's affiliated with the university, although quite frankly you wouldn't necessarily know. They have supposedly, you're not supposed to have anybody visit your accommodation whatsoever, so that's, even though we're not in Tier 3, and this was prior to Tier 2, we weren't supposed to have people visit our accommodation, but we didn't actually receive any information telling us that at all. It was sort of just rumours. And I think sometimes with the university as well, you have similar sorts of things. Like in the letter, they mention things like a mobile shop. And I think I know which shop they're talking about. I wouldn't have said that it's a shop at all. So I think perhaps they're being a little bit, like, exaggerating some of the aspects of the things that they're doing.
Yeah.
But I have received emails and things, emphasising the fact that there is support. So I do think they have put in extra measures. And I do feel like the lecturers have done really well in trying to make you, like, get the most out of all your seminars and stuff, because it is really difficult, especially when you've had also seminars that have been in physical and had to go online. I think they've handled that transition quite well, and it's sort of been much more consistent than it was during lockdown, where I basically just didn't really have any seminars because they didn't go ahead. So I think they have done the actual online learning quite well. I think maybe it's going to be an interesting situation to see how they handle it with the tier three restrictions coming into place. I sort of hope that there won't be things like more student parties and stuff as a consequence of pubs and restaurants closing, but I suppose we'll just have
to. I don't think anyone wants to risk a £10,000 fine.
Yeah, I mean, you would think there was that one in Kimbolton Avenue in Lenton the other week of the 40 grand. Although, admittedly, that was Nottingham Trent student, so I do want to emphasize.
Oh, we don't take responsibility for them.
Exactly, none of us
I'm
surprised.
Not surprised.
Yeah, that's what happens. Yeah, so, I mean, you'd think it would be putting more students off, but I suppose it is like there are always going to be a certain number of students that are going to do that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's also an attitude of like, oh, it won't be us, you know.
Exactly, like
until it actually is.
And maybe with less parties as well. When there's one party, maybe more people go to it as a consequence. Yeah. Like it ends up, would normally have 20 people, it ends up with 50 people because people hear about it and are like, oh, like no one else is having parties or whatever. I don't know. But yeah, I think we're going to move on to the next story, which is Joe's story. I think that's your story about Generation COVID.
Yeah, I'd love to say we're moving on a bit more upbeat, change the tone, but if anything, it's going to get a bit more bleak. We always seem to pick these stories up on a Monday because they sort of happen over the weekend and we get the brunt of bleak stories. But anyway, this is the BBC Panorama report that 16 to 25-year-olds were more than twice as likely than older workers to lose their job during, and 60% of 16 to 25-year-olds saw their income fall over that period. I mean, you couple this with we know that young people are more likely to report symptoms of depression and mental symptoms, or reporting of it has gone up 80%. So it presents this kind of sort of apocalyptic picture of job market in years to come. And I often think that even pre-COVID, we were sort of shielded as I thought I could ride away, graduate, everything will be smooth though, that it'll all be sorted out. But I wanted to ask you whether, given that that time is getting closer, do you feel anxious about job prospects after uni?
I think it is definitely concerning reading the article about the current job prospects and the general market. It's not, you know, looking great. I think with any, the economic consequences of COVID are going to be absolutely devastating for sure. And I think the problem with that is inevitably young people are the ones who end up getting affected really severely by it. Because, you know, it's just very hard to get anything where, like, often when you have a young person, a company either has to be in quite a good position economically or also just be like, be willing to invest in I guess the future. And if you're trying to just maintain your company every single like day, it's not really something you're not going to take on an extra young person who you're going to train up potentially, because I mean you don't even necessarily know your company's going to be okay in 10 years. So I think inevitably a lot of this is a massive problem for young people. It's hard enough as it before to get a job, let alone now following COVID. It's not a good position for a lot of graduates, and particularly I do feel sorry for graduates who are in potentially like the performing arts, which has notably been sort of left behind, I guess, from the government a bit as far as support goes, and also if you anything in tourism or sort of customer facing is going to be difficult. Yeah, it's not very positive, I wouldn't say personally.
I think another thing the article made really clear was the sort of the social inequality that's going to come out of the economic fallout from COVID. The article sort of gave two case studies of two people that had been affected by socioeconomic inequality. I think that's only going to get worse as we come out of COVID, and especially if the government doesn't sort of prioritise trying to minimise the impact of inequality.
Yeah, so the example, also one of the ones they gave was Rashid, who was a 23-year-old who had been secured a place on a fully funded pilot's training course. And flying schools, basically, when you also become a pilot, it's very, very expensive. It's like one of the most expensive, like, sort of, I guess, trainings you could do, because you sort of have to fund it. But obviously he managed to get funding, but the problem is with things like these, schemes are going to be sort of cut, and you know, there's going to be, it's just going to be harder for, I think, yeah, inevitably it's always going to be, it's not going to be businesses which are going to be paying out, I don't think, for a lot of the economic problems. It's going to be people who would have been employed by the businesses. It's going to be people who would have had training contracts and so on with big businesses who are going to be dropped because they can't afford to do that anymore. And any sort of government schemes potentially are going to have a lot less funding. So I think that's probably, you're going to see, it's going to affect people who are already in a socioeconomically, like, in a difficult place. I think they're probably going to be the ones who take the brunt of it.
I agree. I mean, you're not alone, Becca, in that kind of despondent attitude. The Prince's Trust found that 1 in 3 young people are worried that they won't secure their dream job, and 44% have lower aspirations than they did pre-COVID. It's not, I mean, that's not a majority, so yeah, there's still cause for hope.
Yeah,
we're not lost quite yet.
When 40% is still a cause for hope, you know you're in a bad spot.
But I mean, there's a real sense that it's not young people's confidence in terms of job prospects, and you know, we could see the kind of youth unemployment of the 80s, you know. I mean, the government has pledged money for companies in manufacturing, especially, who take on apprenticeships. I think a company gets £1,000 per apprentice they take on, and their wages are subsidized to some level. But I mean, 10 years ago, I think the government paid all the wages pretty much every apprentice in the country, but you're not seeing the uptake yet this year. So it is difficult when companies have to, as you say, Rebecca, prioritize their day-to-day running costs. It's probably not cost-effective to employ an apprentice, even if this grant from the government.
Yeah, I think it is worth noting from a point of, like, hope, really, I guess, that we have obviously been in recessions before, and I think also COVID's a very unusual situation, because it's not necessarily that businesses can't profit, it's just with the restrictions and with the current circumstances, it's very difficult for them to do that. And, you know, the government has been putting in a lot of money into trying to prop up sort of businesses and encourage spending, which hopefully would mean that maybe this, it is a very unusual economic climate, I would say. Like, it's not quite as simple as just going into a recession or a depression, because there were certain particular circumstances around it. So potentially maybe there is more hope than usual. I don't know, but I do think graduates still will be able to get jobs. I just think it is going to be inevitably harder, and potentially take a bit longer. I mean, do you guys feel like, are you guys concerned personally? Are you one of the three?
Yeah, I would say so. Currently the process of trying to find an internship for a year in industry, and particularly in the third sector, and just there just seems to be no money for it at the moment, also because the government hasn't got any money, and none of the businesses have got any money, particularly in the charity sector. But so it's something that worries me, but I understand that everybody's in the same situation. Like you're saying, Rebecca, it's a very specific economic crisis, so hopefully when a vaccine or solution is found, the bounce back can be quicker than another sort of economic crisis where the economy itself has collapsed, if that makes sense.
I think I'm perhaps a little bit more positive, just to add a note of optimism. I've often found, I mean, I've had a couple of part-time jobs, and I've found that I've sort of fallen into them. I think what I'm more worried about is not getting a job, but getting a job that I enjoy and feel like I'm doing something that's worthwhile. I think a lot of people, you know, do tend to fall into jobs necessarily don't enjoy, but need that job to pay the bills. I do think also the government has a difficult, particularly unique problem in kind of marketing new job markets. I mean, you know, there's a big need for employees in the care sector, IT, logistics. And the government has real problems, obviously, as we saw last week, with kind of advertising those jobs. I don't know whether you both saw the adverts with the ballerina advertising the jobs in cyber.
Gosh, yes.
So, I mean, obviously, perhaps good intention,
yeah.
But obviously not the right messaging to attract people to apply for jobs in the new sector.
Incredibly poorly executed that one.
I do feel also like they do this consistently with their certain advertisements. They do tend to prioritise certain sectors and sort of leave others a little bit behind. I know the arts sector is feeling a bit like they've been sort of neglected by the government, in that there hasn't been much funding. And generally speaking, there just isn't much funding overall, like even before COVID, towards the arts sector. And so it doesn't... Again, the advert was... the infamous advert was a little bit poor... poorly designed, I think, but in fact it was part of a bunch of different... It wasn't quite as bad as it, I think, was made out to be.
It was strange, actually, because I think the advert series has been going for a couple of years. But what struck me was someone put another tweet up with annotations on this picture, which gave a list of all these jobs, like the photographer, makeup artist, someone to dress the set, all that kind of thing. These kind of artistic professions that it took to even create the ad campaign.
Yes, so this is the irony. I think it isn't... I don't always think people can entirely understand the art sector. That there was an irony to that, for sure. I think possibly the post-COVID will probably make situations like that worse. I'm not sure the government is going to put a lot of funding towards the art sector. Not least partially because it is also a Conservative government, like it wouldn't surprise me particularly. But that being said, I don't think it's like without hope, the economic climate. I think that there are, you know, jobs and things out there. And I also think potentially lockdown has given people maybe more ideas. I wonder if we would possibly see more people going into education, because of the way sort of lockdown was, is that you literally couldn't go out, you couldn't go out and get a job and things. So I wonder whether maybe people have thought, maybe I'll go into education for a couple more years. If the economic climate's not going to be something where I'm going to be able to get a job, maybe I can just get a qualification instead. Do you guys think that might be possible?
Yeah, maybe.
I think people, certainly I've considered it after doing an undergraduate degree, maybe carrying on to do a master's just for a bit of security, but then you've got to look long term. Are you crippling yourself with debt that you can't pay off because you can't get a job? So it's a vicious cycle, but perhaps that's too soon. Maybe we can hope for this V-shaped recovery to bounce back that we keep talking about. Fingers crossed, anyway.
Hopefully it will be okay. I mean, I think it's just one of those things, and a lot of generations have had to deal with economic recessions and things. So I think potentially this is something that, whilst upsetting, is not something we haven't sort of experienced, this element of it before. COVID's unusual, but this actual going into an economic recession is not something we're completely unfamiliar with.
It's a nice tagline of newspapers, generate COVID, because I characterise us as this oppressed that's got no hope.
Yes, I do think they do sort of have made it like, what about the young people sort of thing, like the future, what
will somebody think of the children?
Yes. That narrative, which is often used. But I think, whilst I do appreciate the sympathies with it, I think, you know, graduates are only too aware of the fact that it's always difficult for young people to get a job anyway. And I think they're quite, you know, generations are notably good at being sort of flexible and just having to deal with these situations. Hopefully there'll be more government support and schemes, because that's really what matters, and that people who can't necessarily afford things like the training contracts that were mentioned in the articles will still be supported. I suppose that's sort of the main thing that we can sort of hope for. I think we're going to move on to the next story, which I believe is your story, Freya, about, again, a really positive story about Poland's abortion.
Yeah, moving away from COVID, but sticking with sort of dreary theme. So there's been some protests at churches all across Poland in protest of the new abortion rules that have come into play. So abortion has basically been effectively made illegal, because now it's only legal in cases of rape, incest, or in protection of the mother's life. So 98% of what would have been legal abortions are now going to become illegal. Yeah, I wonder what you guys think of the protest specifically and think of the ruling itself.
I think what struck me was the presentation of these protesters as sort of a fringe movement, when their ideas really are quite mainstream much of the developed world. And I don't know about you, but Poland never strikes me as a, I think it's quite a modern country, or that's certainly the perception that I've got. So I was so shocked that public opinion in favour of the poll at 65% agreed with banning abortion other than in those two cases. So that really shocked me. This is a sort of modern European nation that has such archaic laws.
I'd say I sort of in a certain to a certain degree I wasn't that surprised. I think also with the two sort of contingencies that they've made with it as well, like the fact that you have like there are other situations like you said, a rape and incest where you the rules also sort of don't apply. I think that possibly is why as well. There's been quite a high vote because I'd say those are probably one of the those are often the cases that are brought up as the sort of an against abortion so as pro-choice sort of arguments so perhaps that's how they have managed to just about like sort of sneak in that being said I wouldn't have personally said that Poland's that progressive perhaps as a country so potentially when I say progressive that's sort of a very Western idealized sort of version of it but from my personal opinion, I wouldn't have said it. I'd say it's quite a conservative country, even for like a sort of Western country. But that being said, sorry, European country. But it is still quite surprising because it isn't a very modern sentiment. I say more countries are becoming pro-choice rather than certainly in Europe than they are pro-abortion. So this certainly was a surprise, and I think it. On another note, it is quite worrying because we are still seeing quite a lot of very conservative leaders just across the world, sort of promoting things like this. So we've got in America, this is again going to become a concern that people are worried that Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned and that basically that abortion is going to be made illegal again. So this is potentially concerning on a just a world front. I don't know what's your opinion for it?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And if when you contrast this case with what's happening in America, there's a lot of sort of debate and discussion going on around the potential that Roe v. Wade is going to be reversed. Whereas I feel like this ruling has kind of come out of nowhere. I was reading sort of some analysis which said that the public hadn't been asking for a ruling, nor had the parliament. It just came from the influence of the Catholic Church on the judiciary, which I think is another issue that the article highlights is the influence of the sort of Catholic Church minority in terms of population, but having quite a big influence on the judiciary, which I think is really concerning.
Yeah, sort of like the loudest voices, I guess.
I mean, I don't think, again, maybe it speaks to my lack of knowledge on Polish politics or this issue particularly, but I don't think it's an argument that we have here anymore. It is seen as a given that women have a right to control their own bodies, and I don't think that's an argument that we have here or need to have here at all.
Yeah, and I think there are, pro-life groups in this country, but they tend to be quite fringe and sort of small religious minorities normally. I think you're right, Joe. It doesn't really enter public discourse seriously as a question of whether we should make abortion legal in this country, which is, great, but obviously that's not the case in Poland. So yeah, 98% of legal abortions will now be illegal under this new law, which is very
I mean,
concerning.
is there any sign that the groups had any kind of mainstream success in combating the law? Is there a sense that the population actually doesn't want to ban abortions, but the Roman Catholic Church has so much influence that they don't feel they can express a different opinion? I don't really know.
I'm not sure in terms of whether there's been any sort of political movement coming from the protests that this law might be changed, but there's been 38 million people outcrying in terms of protest against this law. So there's definitely a large-scale public support for the protests. And just seeing some like images and videos of the protest, there seems to be quite heavy police presence at the protests, which is also very concerning.
Yeah, I also was surprised by the way that they phrased it, because there's that, I think both of you and Joe make a point about the fact that it sounds like it makes it seem like it's a fringe movement, and it's like they're protests, and it's not, ironically, the Catholic Church seems to be the people who are in the minority, and yet somehow they're not, like somehow people seem to be agreeing with them about the initial abortion case, but there are a considerable number of protesters. I mean, even the way the BBC described it, protesters disrupt church services, sound like there aren't that many, you know, like it's like one group almost, and that doesn't seem to be the situation. It seems there is outcry across the country about it. I also would say that it's generally abortion is considered, perhaps naively, as a thing sort of in the past, you know, that previously this it was considered to be like a really wrong thing to have an abortion, and since then we've sort of progressed and you know realized that it's not really acceptable to force people to give birth from by the state, you know, and autonomy for women and all that, you know, feminism and so on. But it's sort of strange that we are going what feels like quite backwards. You know, this wasn't an issue that anybody was even speaking about, and suddenly the church has seemingly put pressure on the Polish government, and now an entire country is banning 98% of abortions. It just seems quite absurd.
Yeah, I completely agree, Rebecca. And if America in the future, particularly if Trump wins the next election and abortion becomes outlawed in America, that's going to be, you know, a huge blow to the security of the rights of women in countries that we see as like progressive and liberal, and it's very, very scary.
Yeah, the idea of Roe v. Wade being overturned is so surprising, because it seemed like such a win. When, like, if you study it historically, it seems like such a big moment. Like, wow, this is something that's going to be like sort of cemented into history. And it would appear that that is not the case, and that things can be very easily changed, sort of politically speaking. Like, it's not stable in any way, which is very unnerving. You know, it doesn't feel like you have really much security even within legal laws as a woman. So. Yes, slightly concerned
It's like the
by.
Handmaid's Tale kind of come to
It
life.
is. It's like it's come to life.
Yeah.
Well,
And
they
actually,
were
a lot
dressed
of the
as,
protesters were
yeah.
wearing Handmaid's Tale outfits, I think, to make that point exactly.
Yeah, I think it does also
Very surreal.
remind people of, like, I guess, both the importance of going out to vote, but also the real significance in the fact that laws do not always protect people, I think, as much as they are thought to. So, like, historically speaking, you know, it's like women's suffrage was considered one of the biggest moments ever. But in reality, you know, we still are fighting sexism every day today. Not to say that it hasn't obviously massively improved, but things like suffrage doesn't automatically fix everything right away, and laws. Even with Roe v. Wade, there's still massive stigmas around abortion nowadays. So even with laws in place, it doesn't sort of remove prejudice or massive inequalities in society. So perhaps this is just sort of like a reminder of that in a way. I don't know. Yeah,
Yeah.
not the most positive
I
for
think
sure.
with the sort of social stigma point that you're making, Rebecca, is that the article was saying that I think it was either 80 or 800, which I know is quite a lot of difference, to 100,000 women were going abroad from Poland to have their abortion when it was legal because of the social stigma attached to it, which I think just highlights exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Like, it is just really it is a really contentious topic. I'd say it's probably one of the most contentious topic that is often advocated by sort of liberal people on like a liberal political spectrum. So Yes, it is very controversial in of itself. It has also said in the article that recent opinion polls suggest a clear majority is against making the abortion law stricter, which is something, but I would also still say that it's incredibly strict as it is, like having these sorts of abortion laws. I mean, basically what it seems to imply as well is in cases like where a woman has effectively had a miscarriage, they can't get rid of the baby because it's a considered abortion still. People don't consider things like that as part of it, but the baby doesn't have to be alive for it to still be considered an abortion. And even more concerningly, in places like America, if you don't get an abortion within a certain period of time, which is like a very short window, then it's considered potentially that you could have the woman go to be prosecuted for murder. And also this happens in cases of miscarriage as well, because you have to be able to prove that your miscarriage was natural and that you didn't bring it on yourself. And it's things like this, I think people maybe just don't understand the whole issue. Like, it's really quite problematic. That's definitely the thing that probably scares me the most about potentially abortion laws being overturned, is that you could go to prison for something just like happening to your body.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really positive today on the Pulse.
Yeah, do join us again for the discussion of the most alarming news stories that are going on in the world.
On the plus side, like, there have been a lot of protests. We may see an overturn of decision. Really hoping that will happen. I don't really even understand how this has managed to happen so sort of sneakily. Like, the church have just put pressure on the government out of nowhere, possibly maybe emboldened by other things that are happening in the world. I have no idea. But, and then, yeah, it's just sort of like happened. And now there's, you can't have an abortion in Poland.
Out of nowhere, yeah.
Really worrying. But on the so hopefully there may be, the protests will be able to change something if it is a minority, and the Roman Catholic Church is in the minority there. I think we're gonna have to end the Pulse here anyway, because we've sort of run out of time. Hopefully tomorrow's Pulse will be a little bit more positive and there won't be either COVID or abortions featured. But like, we do have to, the problem with Mondays is we have to get these stories out of the way, so you know. Yeah. So you can follow the Pulse as ever on Twitter, where you usually will be able to find out what stories we are doing. Today's Pulse is also slightly unusual because we're not playing any music, but we should be doing that as normal tomorrow and the rest of the week. On Wednesday we will be covering the US election and what's happening with that, what our thoughts about what the we predict the election to be, and also just generally explaining how the processes work and so on. There will also be a special on the following week, on the Wednesday again, I think, about the actual election and what's happening with that. The Pulse is, as ever, every weekday except Wednesday, 5 till 6. And you can follow us on our social medias, UrN1350, on Twitter and so on. Instagram and Facebook, to find out what stories we're covering and also listen back. So yeah, thank you for listening, and yes, see you. Hopefully you'll join the news team tomorrow.